So we're going to focus today on a couple of key issues. It would be much more fun for me, and I'm sure for all of you, and I do recognize I am standing between you and the bar, so we're going to try and move through this and really hit on the issues that are important to you. But what would be more interesting, what would be more helpful, I think, to all of us is for you guys to ask questions. Here's your chance to know what we're telling your employer clients when we work with them to pick health plans and the related services. So we're going to talk about understanding the buyer as well as how you can demonstrate value and ROI that works for an employer and for the consultant or broker who may be reviewing you in some of the areas we talked about here. So let's talk about the buyer. Just a couple of points. I think most of you know this. Who is buying the services will drive the way that you are evaluated and the way that the decisions are made. So let's talk corporate. First, you've got the basic HR versus finance. What HR wants, what finance wants, maybe two different things. Your evaluation will be different depending on who's driving the bus. So to the extent you can find out who's making the decision or who's the key decision maker, you'll know whether you're going to be biased to a financial decision versus a total care decision for the most part. The other thing that at least is driving us crazy is the role of procurement. As you move, procurement currently, initially was just a very large employer issue, but it's moving down into smaller marketplaces. The role of procurement turns this decision, it makes the purchase quite a different situation, including the fact that you may not get the direct access to the decision makers and the users of the plan services. You may be barred by procurement to actually getting to talk to in the way that you'd like and sell yourselves to the employers that are buying. So be aware of procurement because they buy health services like they buy pencils. From a Taft-Hartley plan, I think you all understand the union market. It's a place where you play the whole issue of a jointly trusteed group, who makes the decisions, as well as your perception as a union-friendly organization. One of the things that you can't underestimate of the importance of is how union members perceive your organization. That will make or break a decision even when all other factors are equal or better towards you. Finally, the other piece in the union world, there's still a tremendous number of self-administered, self-insured union plans. What I mean by that are plans where the fund staff is actually adjudicating the claims. To play in this marketplace, you need to be able to accommodate and work with those groups. Now, many plans are moving away from the self-administered, self-insured because it's really hard to do it well, particularly as a smaller fund. But working with those organizations opens up a nice area in terms of access to more clients that you can be selling your services to. Governmental plans, I think the key thing here between the statutory restrictions is the recurring requirement to bid. So know that when you're in a government market, when you're talking to municipalities, they're going to have a procurement requirement of every X years, and that's part of the price of doing business with them. And of course, ask questions. How about the consultant's role? Well, you have two types of consultants here that are probably going to be involved working with your employers. There are the more traditional consultants and there are the broker consultants. How do you work with and develop relationships so that you even get asked to the party? I mean, certain consulting firms will not even look at smaller or the non-BUCA carriers because they have existing relationships. Also be aware that consultants have preferred relationships as well as their coalitions and other arrangements that they tend to sell and be biased towards. So understanding who's driving the RFP process is really, really important. The other question is what's the consultant deciding and what are the decision makers deciding? How much is getting filtered before it even gets to the employer? Knowing that process will be very helpful in helping you position your services and what you're providing as part of your RFP response. The other thing to note here with consultants is if they haven't worked with you, how do you educate them? How do you develop the relationships that they understand your service offerings and that they'll be more inclined to utilize you, particularly when you're bringing out new aspects of your business? They have biases because if they don't keep in front of it or keep on it, they might not know exactly what you're up to. Understanding brokers. I mean, here the key thing is where's the money going? How are the dollars flowing? What are the commissions? And what is the commission payment structure here that perhaps will bias or influence a decision? I need to be neutral here around who gets selected and who doesn't. Another interesting point that I would bring up, and I tell you the PBMs are all over this, different consulting firms have different models with which to evaluate you, particularly with network discounts in terms of weighting. We know that the major PBMs will look at who is issuing an RFP and tailor their responses specifically because they know how the models work and they know who is going to value what assumptions drive what answers. And they'll give a different proposal if Mercer's doing the quote, if Willis Towers Watson's doing the quote, and if Aon Hewitt's doing the quote. So just be aware that those models are out there. It might behoove you, as you see RFPs coming from different firms, to understand when you did well and when you didn't, because it may be a function of the models that they use to evaluate your bids. Here, I think we've talked through all of this. What are employers buying? This is all pretty straightforward, so we won't spend a lot of time here. We didn't hear a lot of talk about dealing with retirees. That's going to be an interesting issue. I apologize. I missed a lot of the morning. I got a little trouble getting out of Minneapolis last night. But you may see, you may have, that those are interesting bids and purchases as well, and to the extent that you're in that business. And it is declining. It has been consistently declining, but it's still out there, particularly Taft-Hartley and governmental. They're still in the business. Other services that might be purchased, and we'll talk about these, the care management, disease management, catastrophic case management, HRAs and HSA account management. Can you provide a bundled solution? Do you have a way for somebody with a high deductible health plan to seamlessly wrap with the account-based element of that plan? Advocacy and second opinion services, really, really hot in the market. People are out there looking to bring that to their employees as a relatively inexpensive and potentially cost-saving method. We talked at length about the type of financial arrangement, so I won't focus too much on that. Any questions so far? Let's talk. Oh, sure.
She's learning by the end of the day, too. Yeah. They yell at us if we don't have a mic.
Because it's being recorded. I got that.
So my question is, you start off saying that the consultants have, some of the larger consultants seem to have a bias towards the national carriers. When would one of these national consultants be willing to recommend using like a regional plan as part of a solution for a larger group? When does that make sense?
So as you know, this goes in and out of vogue.
Yeah.
Right now we're back at the national solution end of the cycle. Where I see the local market is particular subgroups within business that are geographically concentrated, collectively bargained groups where you will have, whether it's a single employer but a collective union, talk to steelworkers or other, they're all pretty locally based. Those solutions are possible. I'm not hearing from the larger employers an interest in making healthcare local unless their business is diverse geographically. If their business is relatively uniform, then it's it, at least in terms of the vogue, that's not what I'm hearing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that employers are asking for and the things that you might do to demonstrate value. Many employers are, particularly as you get larger into the larger market, are looking for multiple offerings. And a year or two ago, the hot word in employer market was private exchange, right? Everybody wanted a private exchange. They were going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. Basically, from my perspective, you're talking 1980s style flexible benefit plans with a defined contribution. Sorry, but you know, same as it ever was. It's what goes around comes around. But they sounded really sexy, and they were allegedly going to save gazillions of dollars, and I don't think much of that has happened. They've been a really good excuse for an employer, particularly an employer who's been dragging their feet, not doing stuff, to move to a defined contribution approach and offer some choice and put a very robust front end around it, but honestly not necessarily where the initial tout of that market turned out to be. However, the interest in multiple plans as part of a choice strategy is still out there. So your ability to be able to provide different plan designs or different levels of cost sharing and think about how to, especially for an employer on the smaller end of the market, how to pool the experience between the plans and rate the two pricing plans and help them work with an arrangement that will manage choice. Working with their broker or their consultant to help, even in an ASO plan, help them deal with the anti-selection that might happen in the first year when you move to a multiple-tier structure. Providing access to different types of plans and choice. One of the things that seems to be much more relevant in the employer market and even in the union marketplace is the concept that choice is overrated. So as employers have done what they can do and can stomach with respect to cost sharing and increased deductibles, what we're hearing a lot more of, or at least what I'm hearing a lot more of now from my employers, are narrower networks, restricting choice, funding the lowest plan and having you buy up, whether it's a tighter formulary or any of those techniques. Even in the union space, the recognition that may be the next place to go for cost containment is out there. So what can you provide? How do you manage and how do you support from a design and delivery perspective a narrow or a PPO network? How do you deal with the differential? You talked a lot about the out-of-network considerations. One of the things that we're hearing big noise about is the behavioral health out-of-network. I have clients who have been absolutely hammered by the private jet that flies the addicted child to Florida, and the parents are happily putting the kid on the plane saying, you deal with them. But the cost of these things with the daily or hourly drug testing is huge. I have clients who have actually asked, can we eliminate out-of-network coverage in order to deal with this from a mental health parity perspective? So one of the things to think about in your sale is how are you handling the behavioral health component of your out-of-network issue, because it's a real hot button with employers right now. How do you demonstrate that a narrow network or a high-performing network is, in fact, high-performing? How do you assess the population impact? I think your ability to provide data and information and reporting to your clients and your consultants is going to be key in helping you take your proposition and move it forward. A question? Yep, it's coming. Get that mic.
So tying into what Ashley had asked as well, so I'm in the Michigan market, and we have the big consulting houses, and we have the Taft-Hartleys, and we have jumbo accounts, and we have one very large carrier that's colored blue, and then there's
know them well.
Two other carriers, and the other BUCAs stay out. The reason they stay out for a large part is they can't make enough money in our state. Aetna tries and dabbles, United's out, Cigna's out, right. But here's my point, particularly with your Milliman background, in that the large consulting houses that you had referenced, they have their own little black box of network performance that they've created that's proprietary, and that they get proprietary data from the Blues, as does Milliman, managed out of your Atlanta office more often than not. And that network performance is conveyed to the client from the consulting house. Most of us, I can speak for my organization, that being Happen ASR, says we are not going to provide that proprietary data to those consulting firms that then put it in their black box and we don't get the outcome and we don't know how they're benchmarking us. And so oftentimes we don't even get invited to the party on those large groups that you were referencing earlier, and even in the point that you're making about narrow networks and high performing, because they already have their thumb on the scale. So my question to you is, how would you recommend the body of folks that are sitting here deal with that?
So twofold. Number one is that while I recognize, I agree that the consultants have, and so I know Milliman does work around around network evaluation and pricing. Milliman, I know, will bring in additional carriers, but I think the issue is data sharing, right?
Right.
So I can't speak specifically to the other major consulting firms, but everybody's got their own thing.
Yeah.
I think there's probably two elements. Number one is being able to have some independent data that you can provide and educate to them, and to the extent you can get in front of them, the employers themselves, to be able to say, here's data, here's the data you have access to, here's your ability to look at the results of the high-performing network. So data, while some employers, and particularly on the smaller end, are very happy to say, go do it for me, go away, the larger the employer, the more they're going to want to see their data, play with their data, and get access directly to their data. Giving employers data will be helpful. I think the second issue is that if you actually do get invited to the party, please, please look and make sure that you can see how the consultant has portrayed your discounts without giving anything away. They may not show you what anybody else is doing, but look at what they've done to your stuff. Because in the same way the consultants have models that make different results for the PBMs, you're going to have the same thing. And I've got a slide on this. Very same thing with respect to the network discount modeling. Their assumptions that they use, their projection assumptions, the way they treat out-of-network claims, you can really make the numbers do a lot of different things. So to the extent that you can, as part of the RFP, see what's being presented before it goes to the client, the consultant, that will be very, very helpful. Because we typically do that. We send it back, at least the ones that I'm working with, we send it back, and sometimes we'll find, oh, by the way, this is what we assume. So if you didn't assume this in our pricing, you're going to be wrong. And so that being able to tie back, I can't promise you'll always be successful with all the consulting firms, but to the extent that you can get, you know, circle back and see what was presented before a finalist decision is made, that would be really helpful.
I agree, and just to add to it, you know, you've got facility-based CPT-4 codes and you've got non-facility-based. I believe our blue plan tends to use facility-based, which skews the CPT-4 reimbursement levels. I'll bet every carrier in this room calculates the definition of a discount differently.
Oh, yeah. Does every consulting firm sticking the stuff in the model.
That's right. So two or three points makes a difference.
Yes, it does, because those are usually pretty tight decisions. And how they treat in and out of network is also huge. And the assumptions made with the out-of-network claims. So getting back in to look at what they've done with your stuff is going to be very important.
If they'll share it.
If they share it. Yeah, no, I hear you. And you know, you may find that, and I hate to say this, but you may find that there are some consultants / brokers involved with a bid that you'll never win business from. You know, and I think you probably all have had that experience where there's just no way you're going to win. And the question for you from a business perspective is, do you even bother?
Right.
You know, or is there another entry point to the clientele that you want to get that goes around that broker or somebody different?
Agreed. Thank you.
You know, You're welcome.
We've had this come up, and some of our plans have shared with us that they've made a concerted effort to build a relationship and go in and educate both employers and brokers to even get asked. If you just stand back and wait, you probably are not going to have the chance of getting in there. And then the other thing I would say is that if you've got your own employer and they're not doing anything to improve their own health care costs, it's kind of hard to go out and make the case that, you know, you're going to do a really good job with somebody else's account.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the times, the more you can do in your own market and then share that, here's what we've done with our own employees and here's the results we're getting. You know, it may not be their data, but they can see what you're willing to do, then they're much more likely to say, well, in this market,
point.
We know that you can do a good job with that.
I have a question.
Sure.
So did I hear you say that you think maybe at least some markets are ready with a consumer, let's say middle income consumers, ready to make the trade-off of choice and price premium, maybe say 10% premium differential, if the narrow high-performing network, which may be very narrow, is actually high-performing and it's sustainable over time through efficiency, effectiveness, outcome-limiting waste to actually sustain that price differential.
Yes, I believe that's so, and I believe surprisingly that you're seeing it in a union space, and to a lesser extent, but still in a governmental space. So sort of the last bastion for pay for everything, and I want to go to everyone, is actually starting to move because there's only so much you can do in terms of shifting cost to the employees.
Yeah. Does that sort of shock you that actually we're at that point?
It's been coming for a while. You know, the PPO concept, the out of network, who gets thrown out of the network, all of those sorts of things. You're hearing more and more of it. And as you look at pricing, and I do a lot of work in New York City. Any hospital system that advertises at the Super Bowl is making too much money. You know, I mean, really. Sorry, I won't say anything about who that is. Hey, you know. Okay. We talked a little bit about this, but how do you deliver, high deductible health plans, really popular in the corporate space. A lot of folks went there thinking that that was the way to escape from the excise tax, Cadillac tax. How do you support the delivery of a high deductible health plan with a spending account? And to what extent do you have limitations on the design, on the ASO space, on the design that you can administer? Are there things you can't do that employers are asking you for? I think those are the kinds of things to think about in terms of moving forward. The next sort of big topic is, are employers looking to bundle services? Do they want a one-stop shop? Do they want the easy button? Can I just give it all to you and have you do it? Versus, do they want to pick different vendors, either, quote, best in class or from a price perspective? A big issue you're going to have with employers, particularly when it comes to care management or second opinion type of thing, is do they trust you to do that care management yourself? And demonstrating that you can is going to be a challenge. You're going to have to, again, have the data, have the information to be able to show them, here's real data on real people, this is what we've been able to do. And there are some employers that will not ever allow you to manage your own care. I think that's just perhaps a bias among employers. Size drives that. I think you'll be more likely in the smaller side of the market to get the bundling. The larger the employer, the more they're going to be pushing for multiple vendors watching out for each other. From a PBM perspective, I know some of you have your own PBM, some of you have partnerships. It's really hard to beat the big three from a pricing perspective. And the employer market has been hearing this for a long time. The consultants are out there basically saying, the best deals are going to be from the PBMs. We can renegotiate it every couple of years. We'll get you more rebates, et cetera, et cetera. That's going to be a challenge for you. The challenge for the health plan to demonstrate value is to be able to say, by having your pharmacy data, our price is in the range, but really what we're going to be able to do is manage the care, manage the outcome, have the data flow effectively and efficiently to be able to deliver a better outcome and then be able to support that with data. If you're trying to bid the pharmacy piece as part of what you're doing, how does having the data allow you to deliver better health outcomes, as well as, if not with respect to, can you offer some sort of, and you talked about it, can you offer some sort of upside protection on the prescription drugs? I've seen stop-loss products that are drug-only just coming out in the past few years. I've had employers asking specifically for, you got your ASO over here, you've got your medical over here, you've got prescription drugs, asking for drug-specific stop-loss. So how do we handle the particular risk of the high-cost drugs, particularly in the smaller employer market, both as part of an overall package and maybe specifically for certain employers of a certain size who may not necessarily want to purchase broad stop-loss insurance?
Just one comment on the PBM. We have our own PBM. We sell the PBM-only services. Mm-hmm. I've found that the size of the competitor is inversely related to how easy it is to take business from them. So starting with Express Scripts, mm-hmm. we can routinely beat Express Scripts very easily, and then CVS Optum follow. So we haven't had an issue with that.
That's great. Most of the work that we've done with carriers broadly is that we're getting better deals out of the big three. But it really depends on whether they want the business, which makes a difference. It's a size drives it too. You know, different carriers, different PBMs are chasing different business right now. It's union business is really hot for some reason right now, or multi-employer business, perhaps because that may be perceived to be around a little bit longer. I don't know, but good. Okay, all of the management elements, catastrophic care management, disease management, care management, case management, all of these elements are things employers feel like they need to have. And so the question is, do they get it as part of your standard ASO service offering? What comes with the standard ASO servicing? What's an add-on? What's a buy? And I think thinking through that package, that offering, as a marketing opportunity for employers, they're going to want it. They may or may not want to pay for it. And so if they're going to pay for it, how do you demonstrate that it was worthwhile? Again, data, examples, you know, real information will be needed to do that. In terms of, you know, the rest of the market, for the employers who are biased to have somebody else watch what you're doing with respect to their ASO claim payments, how well do you work with those buyers? Do you know what their offerings are? How do you stay competitive? It's probably worth, you know, getting a little bit of intel on what's being sold to employers that is competing with products that you offer. You know, Best Doctors, you know, some second opinion companies. Who's out there selling what in what marketplace, and how does that compare to your offering, both from a price and a return on investment perspective? Let me just go back one sec. In terms of demonstrating value on this, be really careful about how much you promise that you save on this, because there's a healthy measure of skepticism based on a lot of experience with promises and delivery, particularly among the consulting community. So here, you know, again, data, real data, driving, demonstrating what you've been able to do is worth a lot. Putting a lot of fees at risk, for the most part, employers have figured out that your fees at risk and what you promised to do may not necessarily cover. Same thing with your network discounts, pricing, guarantees. So there's more skepticism, a healthy skepticism in terms of the promises that can be made from some of these programs. Telehealth, hot with employers. Now, interestingly, you know, we have telehealth. Milliman is a firm of consultants, a lot of health consultants. We had 3 people signed up in the first 6 months. Okay, so how do you, you know, what is your telehealth strategy? How do you roll it out? How are you doing it? Does what you do to encourage the utilization of telehealth vary by demographics, vary by geography? It's an opportunity. It's a differentiator. Employers are interested in it, but the question is, what's your strategy? What are you doing? And more importantly, how successful are you at getting the members to use it? You know, and that's the real challenge. And you know, the major firms that are out there are still not necessarily demonstrating huge success, particularly in certain populations. But it's a hot button with employers. It's a check the box must have. And so it would be useful to have a strategy, have a plan, and if you can do so, demonstrate that you've been able to drive some utilization towards that and the price savings that comes with it. Wellness. Well, wellness is like about as amorphous of a topic as you could possibly have in the employer community. There's a really wide range of what wellness means to various groups. See, I've got a Fitbit on. We have wellness. But what we're seeing is more interest in the wellness side from the Taft-Hartley, the collectively bargained groups, as well as the governmental. So it's been sort of way in the corporate employer space for a while. It's sort of making its way out. The question is, you know, what exactly are you able to offer from a wellness program once you understand what the employer thinks of and looks for when they're talking about wellness? How do you portray the savings opportunities? How do you demonstrate, and do you portray it as a savings opportunity or the right thing to do? Because many employers are not necessarily looking for the giant win in terms of the financials. They want to do the right thing, and they know that, hey, if we actually improve the percentage of individuals who are getting their annual physical, who are getting their screening in the short term, it's going to cost us money. So, you know, be careful how you try and sell it. You know, the CFO may want to hear it's got an X times spend ROI, but providing the data that says we're able to move your immunization rates for kids up to here or your preventive screening rates up to here, that can be as important of a sell, and I think that's undervalued in terms of most RFP responses or most pitches. And so recognizing the right thing to do element and not necessarily focusing on the pricing is probably something to focus on.
Yeah, I just had a question. How are you seeing employers actively involved in the wellness initiative in terms of, you know, driving incentives and offering, you know, programmatic on-site offerings within their employer sites?
It really varies. We have some employers who, you know, who are very, very engaged, wellness coach, lots of incentives, mm-hmm. financial incentives, plan design differentials, contests. You go there, you can't get a cookie if your life depended on it in a meeting, you know, no soda. And we have others who say, we're doing wellness, we gave everybody Fitbits. Yeah. It's great. So it really varies, and I think the employer's perception of how much they're doing really varies. They may say they're all into wellness, but for their definition of wellness is really, really narrow.
Okay.
Great. Okay. The other part of this is wellness may actually be a check-the-box required to be able to do that as part of your offerings may help get you to the table. So thinking through what exactly you're selling as a wellness opportunity, because something is going to be expected, particularly from most of the consultants and brokers, is something to just be aware of from an employer marketplace perspective. An interesting thing that we've had, and this might be an area for differentiation, is there are still on-site clinics out there. They're becoming more prevalent in the union space. I know in the city there's a couple of really, really good ones. I work with a union in Minnesota that has a fantastic clinic. And the question for them when going through a recent RFP is, who do we get that's comfortable and able to work and coordinate with an on-site clinic? And so not only the traditional employer-sponsored clinics, but the union-sponsored clinics, how can you work with a clinic to support what they're doing in terms of the primary care management or the care management that they have? How do you help data flow? How do you coordinate and hand off from what's happening in a clinic and a primary care visit or a preventive visit to the ongoing information? And I think particularly for your plans, to the extent that there are employers with the geographic concentration enough to set up a clinic, might be worth thinking about your strategy for working with and coordinating around some of the clinics that are out there. We talked a lot about stop-loss coverage, so I'm not going to go. You guys had a much, much, much more interesting conversation. Just note that this is a high-commission product, and employers actually have figured that out. So, you know, there's some real interesting discussion about whether you price it through a broker or whether there's the availability of a non-commissioned product, particularly with the larger employers. Okay, let's talk a little bit about network discounts. And we did go here a little bit. You know, how does your, you know, obviously the pricing varies by the assumptions that you use to provide the specific discounts. We talked about that, but other elements of discount pricing. In and out of network, who's outside of the network and how expensive will that be? How do you capture and how is your strategy for the out-of-network coverage that might come to a plan? How is your pricing being impacted by hospital consolidation? If the hospitals are buying up all the docs and all the freestanding facilities and slapping facility fees on, how do you manage that? How does your network deal with the consolidation that's happening in many, many areas, happening in your area, it's happening in New York City, happening all over the place? The ACOs and other payment models and pricing, you guys were talking about that before, but employers are aware, and employers are asking the question, how does an ACO make, how do the ACOs that you have, if you have an ACO network, how does that affect my pricing? How exactly am I going to see that? How are the claims going to get paid? What does it mean to me as I'm looking at my experience? And I think having a good answer of what the ACOs will mean to an employer from a dollar flow perspective would be useful. Yeah. Okay. It's okay.
I don't need that. So this reminded me of something that you said a while ago on the out-of-network and the behavioral health and the mental parity. Can you define a little bit further? We kind of went past that pretty quickly. What that problem is that you're talking about? If you have an out-of-network, as long as you're paying it the same as any other out-of-network benefit, I guess.
Well, so the out-of-network. So if the providers are completely out-of-network, and particularly these behavioral health providers, there's limited. They're perceived to be abusive in terms of the 4 times a day testing, your $200 shot, urinalysis, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem is that there is limited ability, if they're out of network, to control the utilization aspect, more so than the price, and then the balance billing issue. Drug testing you when you walk from one side of the campus to the other, because even though you're on a sealed campus, each time you change buildings, that's what those facilities are doing. And they're not charging the patients, because they want to be able to, you know, pick them up and fly them down to Florida or, you know, someplace warm. That typically happens in the Northeast, you know, starting in about November, you know, and right after the New Year, you get this real flood of substance abuse treatment cases in the early part of the year. At least we've seen that with a number of our employers. Mm-hmm. Okay. Narrow network products. And so the question here, and I think we touched on this, is what information can be provided to the consultants and to the employers that supports a network as a high-performing network? What are your criteria for including or excluding providers from the network? What kind of financial information about the cost impact or the quality impact can you provide to the employer, to the consultant, to say, this is my high-performing network, this is what it means financially, but this is what it means from an outcomes-based perspective. You're going to want to be able to demonstrate both as part of the sale, because employers will select the high-performing network if they recognize that there will be price savings as well as still quality of care and more less enough provider access so that their members are not completely freaking out. So they're willing to take a little bit of noise. They're willing to say, yeah, if you go here, you know, we don't want you going here because it's the most expensive. But if your network is so narrow that there's no choice and you get the, you know, the bake sale to support the poor individual who's got to go out of network for cancer treatment, then that's not going to probably fly in an employer world. So they're willing to go part of the way, but most of the employers I work with aren't really willing to say, too bad, so sad. So it's a slope that they're kind of managing with. And then the question, and I think you talked about it earlier, is how do you deal with the custom networks? How do you deal with the requests? You know, historically, employers would say, got to have X, got to have this, got to have whatever. Not so much anymore, although making sure that your networks meet the geographic variations of the population are going to be important, and I think that was discussed this early. I guess the other question is, how much are you willing to tweak a network versus a full customized? How big does an employer need to be before you'd be willing to consider a more custom network solution? You know, what would you do for 10,000 lives? You know, and thinking through those kinds of things and understanding what you can present to the market and where the line gets drawn for your flexibility and you're willing to do something different for the different groups. Because every employer thinks they're the most important, of course. It's a question of, you know, how does the size and the credibility impact what you can do for them in terms of developing or building products? Okay, performance guarantees. Your consultants are probably asking for this. So I'm not sure your brokers may be. What can you offer? What kind of performance guarantees can you offer on what you do? There's the traditional ones, which are the transactional. Am I paying claims accurately? Did I set up your programs right? Do your members fill out the satisfaction survey and give you a decent grade? You've got the whole aspect of the return on investment of the care management programs. One of the things I would caution is be really careful to get agreement on how that methodology will be calculated. As someone fighting with two care management companies on behalf of one of my employers about how to calculate ROI, much better to get it up in writing up front as opposed to coming back and saying, this is the way we do it, and having somebody say, no, 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 that's not going to work. Discount guarantees. There's been more of an expectation of an overall discount. Now, this is sort of like overall discounts in PBMs. There's magic math that can happen here. But there, don't be surprised if you're asked to give an overall network discount guarantee along the way, and think about how that happens, whether it's by line item, by service line. But you may see that. The other thing that you're likely to get asked for is trend guarantees. As people move to the ASO area, they're on the hook for claims. The question is, do you get asked overall, can you limit my trend? And yes, I'm willing to sign up for all of your care management programs, but you have employers who are really thinking that if they can somehow put you at risk, like they may have done in an insured arrangement, to say, can you manage my trend to a certain level? And you're likely to see more of that as employers kind of pull their hair out trying to think about how they continue to deliver health benefits without simply shifting all cost increases to employees. And there are some that do that. This is an opportunity to distinguish as you get asked for it, or even in anticipation of a particular piece of business that you want to win. Can you throw some sort of guarantee out there, some sort of financial cap, put whatever caveats you want on it, but can you distinguish yourself in terms of being able to work with an employer, particularly an engaged employer, to manage the cost increases? I talked about this a number of times, but I can't underestimate the value of experience reporting. What kind of experience are you able to give your employers? And the larger they are, the more they're going to want to see that or have their consultants see it. You know, how often do you report to them? Do you have an annual report for a smaller client, quarterly? When information is requested, how quickly can you get it back out to them? What kind of analytics are you able to provide? And clearly there's a balance here between credible and useful information and providing, you know, a whole bunch of reports. But the larger you get, the more the expectation will be that you can provide drill-down type reports that will allow, at least on a line of business basis, the employers to figure out exactly what's wrong. Because that's how a lot of them do their plan design. They're going to look, and they're going to look at the areas that are out of whack, and they're going to say, hey, my emergency room use is nuts. That's obviously an easy example, but my emergency room use is way above the book of business. I got to up my copay, or I've got to put a penalty in, or I've got out-of-network utilization problems, or I've got some real high utilization in certain areas, and this is how I need to think about if I'm going to adjust my cost share, how do I manage behavior? They'll work with you, but they also need to use plan design as a tool. What are you doing with respect to high-cost claims? Is the first time that people see high-cost claim information going to be when you do your year-end review after the year's over? Probably not quite as good as being able to have an early warning system, especially, you know, for employers who may have just danced above the line where they think they need stop loss, which is usually the year that you have the big high-cost claim just by probability. How about diagnostic category? Can you, in a large enough employer, can you provide information about, you know, disease burden, what's going on? How about top facilities and utilization in-network, out-of-network? From a pharmacy perspective, GDR, clearly a response, but what about your specialty drugs? What about mail order utilization? How quickly, how regularly can you provide that? Is that a push, or is it available on the web or electronically? What access do you give the employer or the consultant to the reports? And can you price the impact of changes? You know, the folks with consultants should have them be able to do that, but to the extent that you're talking to an employer and working as part of a strategy that includes managed care, can you tell them what you think changes in their plan design will be? Since they don't have that fully insured premium to go to, they're going to be looking for somebody to tell them what the expected premium equivalent impact is, or the overall cost. Other things that drive the decision. The account team is really important. Can they work with you? Do they like your account team? Are they feeling comfortable? They feel like they're being listened to. Customer service, still important. I mean, a crappy plan well delivered still has more value than a really rich plan that people can't use. And so understanding and delivering benefits well. How about implementation? Most of the HR departments that we work with, are completely lean. They're completely understaffed, overworked. They want you to just help them do that. So SAIL here is your implementation team. We'll make it easy for you, the easy button approach, or we can provide these resources, or we can help you. That's going to help. It's going to go a long way in terms of getting somebody to change, because a lot of times inertia is really about, I don't really feel like making the effort, even though you may be a better provider. Too much effort for me to change. I just can't. I don't have the resources to do it. Accuracy of coding. Do you get it right all the time? Are you doing a good job? I think carriers who are traditionally weaker in the administrative area, and that includes some of the larger ones, are getting more penalized for that than they used to, as network discounts are tending to come closer. There's not necessarily the overwhelming, I always win because I'm carrier X. And so when the administrative and the coding and the actual delivery of benefits isn't right, it's much more of a penalty, it's much more noticed, and employers don't want to deal with it. It's noise. It's sort of non-value-add noise. Your contract, you know, legal department, how tough is your legal department? How much of a pain is it going to be to actually sign that contract with you? Is it going to take 6 months? That actually matters more than it used to, as corporate legal staffs have shrunk as well, even slowly than everything else, but they're still shrinking, and taking time to get a contract is also, and a reputation of having to take time to get a contract is something that may actually impact folks. And then, you know, how much ongoing support? What can you do to help them help themselves to deliver benefits, particularly as it gets to the HR staff and or the fund staff? So how much you can do in the intangibles, in the non-direct delivery of healthcare, to help an employer actually get this done is important. Okay, so I'm to kind of breeze through this, but any other questions?
I'll have a question to kick it off. I think you were here. We had a nice discussion before about reference-based pricing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you here for that?
Yes.
Okay. My question to you is, are your large employers showing interest in procedure-specific reference-based pricing, like
yes.
hips and knees
yes.
and hemodialysis? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The large employers with enough volume to be able to look at, so there's two sorts of groups. You have the very large employer who will cut a specific deal with a specific facility/practice to say we want to use a center of excellence. Oh, sorry, that's center of excellence. Reference-based pricing, yes. Hips and knees, you got to have enough volume to do it, because a lot of times, unless you have a sufficient number of cases in that area, it's not necessarily going to result in the kind of savings that moves the needle. But a large employer or a geographically concentrated employer or an employer that's where there's a real difference in the pricing of the facilities in the area, New York City, will look more to reference-based pricing. But I think you got to have size, and size and volume, and you have to have enough differentiation that there's something you're going after. So, yeah, they want to do it.
I guess I'll ask that same question a slightly different way. It doesn't mean you answered the question wrong. It's just I'm curious about this side. Are your larger clients saying, we're done with networks? Why should we worry about working with a contracted network when there are these entities out there that say pay X of Medicare, and then we'll represent them, you know, if they balance bill, they'll represent us, and we don't have to pay as much money as we do through a negotiated contract? That's the question I have for reference-based pricing.
Yeah, I think that is the marketing of that in the various is different. You know, I haven't seen that, for example, in the Taft-Hartley space. They're not running out in the Taft-Hartley space and trying to sell that. I think that's more of a corporate phenomenon, and I also don't know how universal it is. You know, who's being targeted? Is that a national employer versus a local employer issue? So I don't have a good answer for employer. I don't believe that all employers are saying, yeah, let's just pay X percent of Medicare and be done with it. Even those that have that strategy doesn't always avoid employee noise. You know, even though because there are just places where it doesn't really work, or services where it doesn't work. And I think that's one of my largest employers has been trying to figure out what the right number is for a long time. And every time they change it, something else, some other measure just becomes crazy.
So, related question. So I had a conversation a while back. Are you seeing any employers kind of almost go to having a contract, like for knees or hips, for example, but where they, and then they've got the defined reimbursement, but then still saying, you can go wherever you want, but I just pay this amount. Anything above that?
Yes.
So you are seeing that?
Right. Here's the price.
Here's the price.
I think the Blues have done that out in California with a couple of the major unions because they're kind of bringing that around. But just here's the price. And what they say happens is that some people in the market just drop the cost to the price so they get full reimbursement because no member really likes to get balance billed. A few people have come up to the price, you know, say, oh, this works. but for the most part, that's not a broad thing. You need to have the volume to be able to really affect that from a contractual perspective with, you know.
Are you aware of states that the state legislators are outlawing balance billing?
I don't know all of the states. I know in New York you have some of the non-emergency or the out-of-network issues. I think it's anybody's guess what the states do, particularly over the next couple of months. And I'm not the legislative lead in our firm, so I don't know.
Other questions or comments? Suzanne, thank you.
Thanks.
Very insightful.